Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we are glad to have you listening this morning. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is at the controls. In this part of the show, we'll talk a little bit about an issue that has been discussed, certainly in popular media, back since about the late 1990s, and it's something that seems to be causing increasing concern, and perhaps for good reason, and that is antibiotic resistance in bacteria, things that make us sick. Antibiotics have been a very powerful weapon in the fight against disease. In fact, when they were first introduced, they seemed to be nothing less than miraculous in their ability to knock out bad germs. Now, though in the years since, in the decades since, we've started to kind of take them for granted. Certainly, that's the opinion of our guest here this morning in this hour, U of I microbiologist Abigail Sollers. She says we take them so much for granted that many of us willingly participate in their misuse without thinking about the potentially disastrous consequences. She's going to be giving a talk on this very subject. This is the 16th annual lecture of the Center for Advanced Study, where she currently is a professor of microbiology on the U of I campus. The talk is Revenge of the Microbes, Are Antibiotics in Danger? And this will be at 7:30 tomorrow night. She'll be giving the talk in the ballroom of the Alice Kemble Alumni Center on South Lincoln Avenue in Champaign, and I'm sure that it's open to anyone who is interested in hearing what she has to say. So you might want to stop by. Also, by the way, she's the co-author of a book that examines this subject, and it's a book that is intended for a general audience. So if you're interested on this subject, you can look for it. The title of the book is also Revenge of the Microbes. It's published by the American Society for Microbiology Press. It is a paperback. So that's also a source of information on the subject. Questions are certainly welcome in this part of the show. If you want to call in, ask questions, make comments, that's certainly welcome. We just ask people to be brief so we can keep things moving along. But of course, anybody who is interested can call in. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Welcome.
I was interested. I was taking a look at the book, Revenge of the Microbes, that you co-authored. And I think it is worth making the point that perhaps talking a little bit about what it was like when penicillin first became available, when we first had antibiotics, and just how significant a development that was at the time. What an incredible thing it was to have that tool that you didn't have before.
Well, I think that people had been, prior to that time, especially during the 1700s and 1800s, when there were so many dreaded plagues like tuberculosis, and before that there had been bubonic plague, of course, but tuberculosis and other diseases of that sort. And so there was almost a public obsession with this because diseases would come through and many people would die or would suffer a great deal. And I think a good example that I give in the book is the treatment of syphilis. When syphilis first broke out, and it was a much more rapidly developing disease than it is today, and people went to horrendous lengths to try to rid themselves of this dreaded disease. So, for example, at that time, about the best they could do back in the 1700s and early 1800s was to they would coat you with mercury and then heat you up. A lot of people didn't survive that therapy, and it was very painful. And usually they would have to do it several times, and most of the time it didn't work. And so the fact that people would resort to something like that, and all sorts of quack remedies at the time, the fact that people were happy to take arsenic as another way of trying to deal with diseases that were potentially fatal, gives you an idea of the level of desperation. And so what happened when antibiotics came along was that suddenly there were these chemicals now that were not poisons like arsenic or mercury for humans, but were poisons for bacteria that were selective in their toxicity. And so all of a sudden you had the possibility of a gentle cure for many of these diseases. And so you could treat tuberculosis, you could treat bacterial pneumonia, another big killer, you could treat plague, and the person didn't didn't die of the treatment. So that was a tremendous revolution, and the introduction of penicillin occurred about the time of the Second World War, there were posters that said, your loved one will come home from battlefield because thanks to penicillin, because infections of wounds were the major cause of death, even more commonly occurring as a cause of death than the trauma of the wounds themselves. So penicillin appeared not only at a time when people were anxious for cures for generally rampant diseases, but also were quite conscious of it in the context of war. And it's ironic that now our Iraq veterans that are returning from the war are once again having problems with wound infections. In this case, it's a bacterium called Acinetobacter that is resistant to many different antibiotics. And so this wound infection thing is back again from wartime-associated injuries. But it affects all of us at some point or another in our everyday lives.
Yeah. One of the things that you do in the book, as I think, is that you try to explain in a way that people who are not don't have a background in biology will get, is a little bit of what antibiotics are and how they work, and also how it is we get to this problem where we have an antibiotic that for some period of time may be very effective, and then we start to see its effectiveness lessen as bacteria develop resistance. So maybe I could ask you if you could do it in a way that's not so technical, to talk a little bit about what antibiotics are and how it is that they work, what it is that they do.
All right. Well, antibiotics are fairly simple chemicals that either inhibit the growth of bacteria or kill the bacteria outright. And those chemicals work by targeting fairly specifically certain aspects of the bacterial lifestyle. So, for example, most bacteria have a rigid coating, a rigid cell wall that is essential for their survival. Without it, they will pop and will explode. And it's hard to come back. It's like Humpty Dumpty, and it's hard to come back from explosion. And so the one type of antibiotic, the penicillin family, penicillin and also vancomycin, target that cell wall and undermine its durability, and therefore make the bacteria susceptible to killing. Since we don't have that cell wall, this is a good example of the differential toxicity I mentioned before, the gentle cure. We have some side effects from penicillin and vancomycin, but for the most part, they don't act on us because we don't have that same type of physiology. So other antibiotics will stop the ability of a bacterium to produce proteins. Now, our cells produce proteins, but fortunately there's enough difference in the machinery for producing proteins between humans and bacteria that you can get chemicals that will go in and hit the bacterial machinery without hitting our human cell machinery. So their antibiotics tend to have fairly specific targets. So that's why they were called bullets, magic bullets, in the beginning, because they hit one specific target, whereas disinfectants, for example, tend to be more general in their action and affect bacteria in a lot of different ways. But they also tend to be toxic to us if used internally.
Mm-hmm. So given that's the way that they work, then a natural question would be, well, why is it that antibiotics don't continue to have the desired action forever? I mean, what's happening with the bacteria that is causing it? It's almost said them. although I think it's interesting that you end up thinking about it in that way, that causes the bacteria eventually to become resistant to that antibiotic so that it doesn't work anymore.
Well, two things that people should understand about bacteria. One is that they divide much more frequently than we reproduce. And so some bacteria can divide every 15 minutes. They usually don't have the opportunity to do that. But they have very short, what scientists call generation times. And that gives them lots of chances to throw the genetic dice and to produce offspring that have the chance to, through mutation, to become resistant. Bacteria can also acquire DNA from each other, and so you can think about this as if DNA is the blueprint for building the bacterium. They can acquire DNA that carries a blueprint for becoming resistant to the antibiotic, so changing the target of the antibiotic just enough so that it still works for the bacterium, but the antibiotic doesn't work anymore. Sometimes bacteria will inactivate an antibiotic. They produce special proteins that do that. And I think another important thing to realize is not just that they divide very rapidly, so they have lots more chances to adapt or to produce progeny that will be resistant, but also how ancient they are. Bacteria were the first forms of life on Earth, and they appeared very soon after the Earth's crust cooled. So that was 3 plus billion years ago, and so they basically run the Earth, and we're latecomers. We were born into their world, and so they have had lots of chance to adapt to various different kinds of environment. They're extremely adaptable, and this is their claim to fame. And so, as I sometimes say, that for us humans, it's very unwise to underestimate a potential adversary that's had a 3 billion year evolutionary head start. They've been around a lot longer than we have, and they're a lot more adaptable than we are.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Abigail Salyers, is professor of microbiology here at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Her research has focused on the bacteria that are normally found in the human intestinal tract, and she's particularly interested in the mechanisms by which these bacteria become resistant to antibiotics. That's what we're talking about here this morning. It's the subject of a talk that she will be giving on the U of I campus tomorrow night, also the subject of a book that she has co-authored that was published, I think, just last year, Revenge of the Microbes, and it's published by the American Society for Microbiology Press. So if that's a subject that you'd like to learn more about, you can look for the book. You also can give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I expect that at the time that, if not at the time that penicillin was introduced, it didn't take very long for scientists to, if they didn't have that understanding of bacteria before, it wouldn't have taken very long before they began to realize that bacteria had the capability to adapt, and that the point would come when penicillin wouldn't work as well as it did, and we have to develop something else. And then the point would come when whatever that was wouldn't work as well as it used to, and we have to develop something else. I mean, this idea of disease resistance of bacteria, it's something that we've known about for a while. We didn't just learn about it last year. Was this always something that we understood, that there was this danger, or did it take a little while before we realized, oh, yes, of course, we shouldn't be surprised by this?
Well, initially, when antibiotics were first introduced, it was a revolution, and the pharmaceutical industry grew up in large part around the antibiotic discovery area. And so pharmaceutical industries were very active in discovering antibiotics. At first, it was very easy to discover new antibiotics, and so what happened was that you had, as one antibiotic would become less useful because bacteria were developing resistance to it, there was another one and another one. What happened, unfortunately, was that there was then a glut of antibiotics on the market back in the 70s, starting in the 70s and continuing into the 80s. And so, and also, the pharmaceutical companies found out that they could make a lot more money from drugs like Lipitor, or drugs that you have to take every day. The problem with antibiotics is that they work too well. And so a simple course of antibiotics can do the job, and you don't need to take it every day for the rest of your life. And so a combination of factors, and I don't mean to demonize the pharmaceutical companies, this is just something that happened. They had every reason to believe that they were well covered with the many antibiotics that were on the market. And so they started shutting down their antibiotic discovery programs. So the number of pharmaceutical companies that now still have antibiotic discovery programs is much smaller than it once was. And it's becoming harder, for reasons we don't completely understand, to discover new antibiotics. So this glut of antibiotics has slowed to a trickle, basically. And a lot of people are quite concerned about this because the number of new antibiotics coming onto the market is quite small today. And it's very expensive to discover them and to bring them to the market. And so we're not covered with that glut of antibiotics that we had before. Unfortunately, when we had the glut, physicians and patients alike there was no reason why they couldn't just use them as they wished. There was no particular feeling of concern. And it's been only very recently that physicians have begun to experience some alarm about this development of resistance. Many physicians didn't believe in it, really, until fairly recently, because if one antibiotic failed, well, they had another one, and everything seemed to be covered.
Well, that gets at the basic point, and I think it's a point that you have made in the way that you've talked about this now for some time. You make it in the book that you think that one significant issue is here the fact that we've just been much too casual about how it is we dispense antibiotics, and that this is partly it's an educational issue. Partly it has to do perhaps with the education and attitude of physicians, but it also has to do with the attitudes of patients, the consumers of healthcare, because they're often the ones who are coming into doctors and saying, look, I'm sick, I don't feel well, give me an antibiotic. And that your argument, I think, is that physicians have been much too accommodating to their patients' desires in cases where they may not even be sure what it is that's making the person sick and whether or not it would be amenable to antibiotic at all, that we've been much too casual in our use, and that has accelerated the process of development of resistance, which would have happened anyway. Mm-hmm. It's just has made it go much faster.
Yes, that's true. And so what's happened is, I don't think we need to play the blame game here. What's happened is that for perfectly understandable reasons, people fell into this idea that we could use antibiotics without any restraint whatsoever. Agriculture has also made a lot of use of antibiotics for the good of the farmers. They use antibiotics to increase growth, to control diseases in these in crowded populations of animals, even use them in some cases on fruit trees. And so we've got this idea. Antibiotics are very useful. That's good. They work very well. But I think people have been much slower to come to the realization that we need to be a little careful with them. And I might mention that one aspect of the use of antibiotics that I think people don't immediately think of is that people ask me sometimes, well, why are you studying the bacteria that are normally in the intestines of humans? I mean, why don't you study something that causes disease if you're interested in antibiotics and resistance to them? In fact, for the average person, if you go into a hospital and get for a surgery and get a hospital-acquired infection, chances are that it will come either from your body, from the bacteria that are normally on your body, or from bacteria normally on the bodies of the people who will be taking care of you. So it's not like bubonic plague or something that sweeps in from outside. This is something that we're harboring within us. And every time you take an antibiotic or a physician is treating you for some sort of disease, they're also treating all the bacteria on your body, especially if the antibiotic is administered orally. Mm-hmm. And so gradually, people can become ticking time bombs, in a sense. Perhaps that's overstating the problem a little bit. But one of the things that we have showed in my laboratory is that the percentage of bacteria in your intestinal tract that are resistant to antibiotics has been rising quite dramatically and quite steadily. And so you become your own danger to yourself, in a sense. And so we need to and many people agree with me on this, that we need to take a broader view to the use of antibiotics, that it's not a magic bullet in the sense that it only treats the one thing that your physician may be assuming that the physician is using the antibiotic properly. The target of that particular antibiotic is not the only thing that's exposed to it. And so people are starting to take a broader view of antibiotic use, that it treats the whole person as well as the specific disease that was the problem in the first place.
Well, this problem of antibiotic resistance has gotten attention certainly in popular media now for maybe about 10 years or so. And I'm sure that in the scientific literature, it's gotten attention too. Has that gotten through now to physicians, the physicians who are doing the prescribing, so that they're now maybe a little bit more careful or more hesitant to actually write the prescription, so that they try to determine, all right, what is it that I'm trying to treat here? First of all, is it going to work at all? And then past that point, well, is this the best way to approach dealing with this?
Yes, I think physicians now are more aware than they have been in the past. Stop for a moment and mention a very revealing thing that was said at a meeting that I attended about 10 years ago by a physician who was saying even at that point that physicians in his acquaintance didn't really take antibiotic resistance that seriously because in their clinics they did not see treatment failures of treatment with antibiotics. And hands went up all over the room and people started to relate their personal experience with treatment failures of antibiotics. And he said, wait a minute, you don't understand that as long as the physician eventually finds an antibiotic that works, it's not a treatment failure. And this, I think, was the attitude that you might have to scroll through three or four antibiotics and finally one would work. Well, that should have caused alarm right away, but I think a lot of physicians were in denial at that point because antibiotics are still working, and they are still working now. And that's why I think, I'm a great believer in panicking ahead of time. You know, let's do something while we still have these very valuable drugs. Let's not just wait to the point where they're where they're no longer useful for to treat most infections.
Let's take a call here. We have someone in Champaign with a question. Line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Does the fact that antibiotics are fed to animals to increase growth, decrease the effectiveness? Does that have an effect?
Well, that's a very good question, and it's one that I've been involved in and the people are now taking a very close look at. The question is, what has the major effect? Is it the overuse and abuse of antibiotics in human treatment of human conditions, or does agriculture play a large role? There's certainly large amounts of antibiotics that are used routinely on farms, and in the case of the farms, it's also a more indirect process. So you have to think of the bacteria becoming resistant on the farm, then entering the food supply. We're now seeing antibiotic-resistant bacteria on plants, so irrigation may be playing a role in this. And so the question is, to what extent do these antibiotic-resistant bacteria that we know are moving through the food supply, to what extent are they actually having a negative impact on human health? And I think we have to be a little careful there because farmers have become quite, in certain areas, have become quite reliant on antibiotics, especially for animal husbandry. And many of us think that it's very important to have a science-based assessment of this, not just to act in sudden panic and anger and try to cut the farmers off. I mean, we've addicted our farmers to antibiotics because we want them to have these concentrated animal populations so that the farms can be efficient and concentrated in somewhere else besides our suburban neighborhood. And at the same time, we want the food to be cheap. And so that combination has tended to encourage the use of antibiotics. And it's a little bit unfair to ask farmers to suddenly go cold turkey on the use of antibiotics without having a good reason for it. So I'm not saying I don't take that seriously, but I think that we need to take a reasoned approach and take into account the farmers.
Well, could I ask another question? This is maybe far-fetched. The fact that they're given to the animals to increase their growth, does that have anything to do with the fact that when humans eat those, is that why we're so fat?
That's an amusing idea. Tell you that the effect on animals is a rather small one, maybe 4 to 5%. Don't know exactly how that works, and that has never been determined. I think the concentrations that the average human would encounter would not be sufficient to have any, and it doesn't work, that doesn't happen for all animals. I also ought to mention, though, that one of the major uses of antibiotics in agriculture is to prevent disease. So if you have a farmer with a flock of chickens, that's a large number of chickens in a fairly small area, or pigs, an outbreak of infection can wipe out a farm. And so the prevention of disease is another important use.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, thanks. I think that it's my understanding that the antibiotics that are given to animals for the purposes of growth acceleration are the dosages are very low.
Yes.
But that the number of animals that get them is very large, and so the issue is here that you're in a sense creating an atmosphere in which a kind of a bacteria like Salmonella, for example, that would already be there and would be something that you've got to be careful of in the way the animals are handled. That what you can do by giving the large amounts of animals these low doses of the antibiotic is that you're encouraging the production of Salmonella that are resistant to antibiotics, so that then, later on, somewhere along the food chain, that in the way that the product is handled, then and people are going to be exposed to Salmonella, if they handle raw chicken, that there you're going to have a problem, because now you have a more stubborn version of Salmonella that's going to be more difficult to
treat.
Yes,
that's exactly right, and that's exactly the problem. So the question is. That we know those bacteria, that certainly the situation in a farm is ideal for selection for resistance because the levels of antibiotic are low. So it gives the bacteria plenty of chances to throw the genetic dice and become resistant. The question is, to what extent those bacteria in our food have an effect on us? Now, Salmonella is kind of an obvious one, although I know people who would argue that, well, that's not so much of a problem because we usually don't treat Salmonella diarrhea with antibiotics. It's just the people who would get the more serious form of Salmonella infection than where the bacteria are actually in tissue that you would have to treat. But what concerns many of us more than that is these other bacteria that are normal bacteria in the intestinal tract that don't necessarily cause disease right away, but that may be able to transfer their DNA that allows other bacteria to cause to become resistant. Whether that kind of activity is occurring in our intestine in any significant degree.
We are a little past the midpoint. I have another caller we'll get right to. I'd like to introduce again our guest, Abigail Salyer. She's professor of microbiology at the University of Illinois. Her research has focused, as she has explained, on bacteria that are found normally in the human intestinal tract and in the mechanisms by which they become resistant to antibiotics, something that we've here been talking about and something that is increasingly an issue for physicians and for all of us. She's going to be giving a talk. This is the Center for Advanced Study 16th Annual Lecture on the subject Revenge of the Microbes, Are Antibiotics in Danger? Tomorrow night, 7:30, in the ballroom of the Alice Campbell Alumni Center on South Lincoln Avenue in Urbana. Anyone interested can attend. Also, if you'd like to get just more information on the subject, you'd like to learn more about it, she's co-authored a book, the same title, Revenge of the Microbes, and that is published by the American Society for Microbiology Press. So you can look for that. And questions are welcome here on the program, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Another caller in Champaign, line 2. Hello.
Yes, thank you. And I unfortunately wasn't able to tune in until late in the program, so if you've already covered this, I apologize. But I know that tetracycline was long used as an effective treatment for severe cases of acne, and I'm just wondering, have you looked into the effects of oral doses of tetracycline over long periods of time, say a number of years, and what kinds of effects that might have for a person who'd been treated that way?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and one that hasn't been broached to this point. It's interesting that use of tetracycline in treating dermatological problems like acne is unusual in the sense that people will be taking the antibiotic for months or years. This is usually with antibiotics. It's a two-week course or a month-long course, and then it's over. But this is the type of use that would promote the development of resistance. Now, one thing that we've learned in my laboratory over the last several years is that there has been a dramatic increase over the last three decades in the amount of the number of bacteria in your intestinal tract that are resistant to tetracycline. And we're trying to understand where that increase has come from, especially since tetracycline in some cases will actually stimulate certain bacteria to transfer the DNA that tells the recipient bacterium how to become resistant to tetracycline and often to other antibiotics because the DNA will contain more than one set of genes. And so dermatological use has received very little attention. And another area that has received very little attention until quite recently is aquaculture, where massive amounts of antibiotics are being used in fish farms. So some of these types of antibiotic use that we don't normally think about when we think about, you know, we tend to go straight to hospitals and say this is where the problem lies. Perhaps we haven't looked at this problem globally enough to really understand what the pressures are. So people are starting to be concerned about this.
So you can't cite specific studies about, adverse health outcomes for people's digestive systems, that sort of thing, who have had long-term doses of tetracycline?
Well, you're starting to see reports like that appear, but this is a very new thing. The sorts of work that has been published has tended to focus on the effects of tetracycline on intestinal bacteria, but whether it's from treatment of acne or whether it's from some other source hasn't really been the focus of the study.
Okay, well, thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go to line one. This is also someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I also tuned in late, so I don't know if you've already covered this or if it pertains to something that you know about, but I'm interested in specifically strep B in pregnancy. I know that women are given cultures near term, and then if they are positive for strep B, then usually seems like from what I've read that then they are asked to have an intravenous antibiotics so that the strep B is not passed on to the baby. And so I've also read that there are some other alternatives that they're looking at, and I'm wondering if that might have an effect on the baby as far as allergic reactions, or maybe that they will become less likely to be able to have antibiotics in the future because they've also built up the antibodies and they're resistant. So I can take this call offline. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you for that question, because it hasn't come up, and it's something that a problem a lot of people aren't aware of. The case of the group B streptococci in the female vaginal tract that can be transmitted to a baby during birth is a clear case of where the risk far outweighs the benefits far outweigh any risk that you can think about, because these bacteria are causing meningitis in babies. It's still a all too frequent cause of meningitis in infants. Now, not very many infants contract meningitis, but it's a devastating disease because even if the infant survives, they can be blind or deaf or have various neurological problems. And so here's a case where use of antibiotics has been shown repeatedly to reduce that risk in women who carry the bacteria. And I would say that in this case, although I'm very concerned about the development of antibiotic resistance, I would definitely say that the group B streptococci are a much greater threat than anything that might happen as a result of the antibiotic treatment. So this is a case where clearly doing something about a condition has had a demonstrated effect, a good effect on reducing meningitis in infants.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to go on and talk some more about the large general question about what we do about the problem of disease resistance. One of the things that you've already mentioned is that we need to, and certainly the message has gotten through to physicians, that it's not good to be really casual about prescribing the medicines in the first place. You touched on something, and I wanted to come back to it a little bit. I'm sure that some people would say, well, if the bacteria are developing resistance to the antibiotics, let's just invent new ones. And you explained that maybe we're not doing that at the rate that we could, in part because the pharmaceutical companies find it more profitable to do their research on other kinds of medications. To what extent, though, are there technical issues? I mean, is it if we set that other question aside, is it the case that if we wanted to, it would just be a matter of applying the effort and the knowledge, and we could develop new antibiotics, and that would take the place of the ones that we have been using before?
Well, some pharmaceutical companies are moving in that direction to use the newest technologies, so something called combinatorial chemistry, which allows you to make many, many, many different variants of an antibiotic molecule or potential antibiotic molecule, what's called rational drug design, which takes advantage of our knowledge of the structures of various bacterial targets. The troubling thing about that is that should have been a miraculous advance in the area, and for some reason it's not yielding the kinds of results that people had hoped. And this may just be because we haven't had enough experience with these new technologies to know how to use them effectively. So we shouldn't, I'm not saying that we should stop doing that, but what some people thought was going to be the magic bullet, so to speak, from research to new antibiotics hasn't had the immediate dramatic effect that everyone had hoped. But there are many people in various laboratories, in academic and industry laboratories, that are taking new approaches. Using, for example, viruses that infect and kill bacteria is something that the Russians did back in the 30s. And then when antibiotics came along, that fell by the wayside as a possible strategy. And people are going back and looking at some of those strategies, but prevention still is a thing that we can't get enough of. That is to try to prevent the infection from occurring in the first place. We can't do that entirely with vaccines. We can't do it entirely with cleanliness, but a combination of this, and also just asking the person who raised the Group B streptococcus problem touched on this, that there are some cases where antibiotics are clearly provide a benefit and are appropriately used in the setting. But there are other cases in which antibiotics are being given where it isn't clear that they're having the effect that you would expect them to have. And so to have physicians pay attention to these guidelines that are constantly coming out saying, this type of use of antibiotics doesn't look like it's working the way we thought that it would, let's just stop that. And to be more rational in our use of antibiotics.
Hmm. Let's talk with someone else. Caller on a cell phone, line one. Hello.
Yes, hi.
Yeah, hi.
I was listening with interest about the tetracycline and the side effects, because in the mid-70s, actually 1976, I was a newly elected county coroner in Illinois. And I had a young teenager who was found dead in his bed, and we discovered through autopsy and investigation, we went all the way to Dr. Milton Helpern, who was the medical examiner of the city of New York at the time, that the young lad had died of an unwitnessed anaphylactic reaction from drinking milk while taking tetracycline for acne. And the only other deaths at that time, this is 30 years ago, attributable to tetracycline were lactating women. I wondered if the doctor was aware of any of that.
Well, tetracycline has been one of the safest drugs that we have ever had, in the sense that the number of side effects has been very small, but there are side effects of antibiotics, and this is something that should always be kept in mind. People who take penicillin can become allergic to penicillin. They can have quite serious reactions to that, and even tetracycline, as you mentioned, there have been a few cases where there have been serious side effects due to taking tetracycline. This has become is even more of a problem with some of the newer antibiotics, where the toxic side effects are greater, and so this makes it even more important to do your risk-benefit assessment very carefully about this, that antibiotics are, I've characterized them earlier as a gentle cure. By comparison to arsenic and mercury, that's certainly the case. But they do have side effects, and I think that this is a going to become increasingly a matter of concern, as some of the newer antibiotics, as I just mentioned, have worse problem with side effects. So you're going to have to figure out is the risk of taking this. Well, first of all, you need to understand the side effect, because if you understand the side effect, then you can say, all right, people who have this particular condition or are doing this particular thing shouldn't be taking the antibiotic. And I think you see more of that today than you have in the past. We need to do more of that to understand the side effects. For a long time, there was a tendency to say, oh, well, you know, there's side effects and they're not okay, so people become allergic to penicillin, just don't give them any more penicillin. But sometimes when a person gets to the point where they have to use penicillin, it really helps to understand where that side effect comes from and whether there are ways that we could use antibiotics differently than we're doing now, especially in certain patient populations, to decrease the potential for development of side effects.
Oh, well, I just wanted to, you know, that was a case that I was involved with, and it simply involved the use of milk with the antibiotic, which caused the reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And just wanted to pass that on.
Oh, thank you.
All right, well, okay. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
And let's go on to somebody in Champaign. Again, this is line two. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if antibacterial cleaning products contribute at all to antibiotic resistance, or is there some sort of net positive by helping reduce illnesses?
Well, originally people thought that the answer to that would be that no, they don't make a contribution, because the target for the antibacterial compounds in soap and other kinds of products have a target that's not the same as the target for most widely used antibiotics. However, there is some evidence starting to accumulate that such products may be helping to select for resistant bacteria in an indirect way. And so this is a very new area of research. And I think the first thing to take into account is that the reports that I've seen recently, and the jury is still out on this, tend to indicate that those products don't work very well, and that you good old hand washing and general hygienic practices are a good idea, and are just as good. And so I worry sometimes about the fact that people who use antibacterial lotions or soaps or whatever become a little bit more careless about how they're handling food, for example, or doing other kinds of things. I haven't seen a study that demonstrates that, but it's something to be concerned about. So I think that this antibacterial products business has gotten a little bit out of hand, and I don't think I can tell you with confidence that we've proven that this is a terrible thing, but it's not necessarily a good thing.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks. I'm glad that the caller raised the question, because that was something that I wanted to bring up as well, because it seems that now there are many products, household cleaning products, personal care products, that have some kind of antibacterial component in them. And it seems like that more and more all the time.
Well, you know, an amusing sidelight on that, or backlight, I guess you'd say, on that story is that the triclosan, which was the original and still is the main antibacterial compound, was originally added to plastics of various sorts, because over time bacteria don't necessarily degrade the plastic, but they'll alter its properties in undesirable ways, lessen flexibility. And so triclosan has been in plastic and products for a long time. Some marketing genius one day decided to slap a label on a plastic cutting board that said this is antibacterial. You know, they didn't add anything new at that point. Then that was so popular toys, of course, had plastic toys would have the triclosan in it. And so that became so popular that people started saying, well, let's add this to other products. And now they are actually adding it to products that might not have had it originally. But I think people are overreacting a little bit in this way. I mean, the concern is not, we evolved over the millions of years of human evolution to handle most bacteria. And it's when you become susceptible for some reason, cancer, chemotherapy, operations, wounds, that you really become susceptible to the bacteria that would come in and cause serious infections, or if there's some sort of an infectious disease epidemic that's going on at the time. And so you're much better off trying to confront the serious potential problems and dealing with them by prevention, if you can, than to think about this everyday exposure. I mean, bacteria, by and large, are good for us, and they, if it weren't for bacteria, we wouldn't be here today because they were the ones that were the recyclers and put the first oxygen in the Earth's atmosphere. I mean, bacteria rule the Earth, and they've actually made it habitable for humans. And so we don't want to get rid of bacteria in general. That would be, well, first of all, we couldn't do it, fortunately, but if we did, we would be in serious trouble. And so I think people have gotten a little bit germophobic, but partly that's because of lack of understanding. And it's easy to understand why people have that lack of understanding, because most people don't have information about microbes and about bacteria. That was one of the reasons that I took the time to write with Dixie Witt this book, Revenge of the Microbes, because one thing that scientists like myself have been particularly guilty of is not taking the time to try to do that sort of outreach to the public. And, you know, the public doesn't on a day-to-day basis see microbes in any other context except germs. Hmm. And they get this alarmist. It's easy to go out and find bacteria on light switch or bacteria on a computer keyboard, which are totally harmless. And the people get those stories are played up. People don't have a perspective on it, and overreact to it. And so I think that one of the most important public health initiatives we could take, and this is something that there's great agreement on, is that expanding the public's information about microbes in a way that helps people to become more informed about protecting themselves.
We're coming down to where maybe a minute or two left. Let me just ask you about the doomsday scenario that some people have talked about. Is there some danger that if this process of disease resistance in bacteria continues, that we could get to a point where we were in effect back to the time before we had antibiotics at all? Would we get to a point where we didn't have anything that would work?
Well, we're already getting to a point where the number of post-surgical infections that are difficult to treat or untreatable is too high, and that could get a lot worse. I think, though, to end this program on a positive note, that we have learned something over the past century. And, for example, laser surgery helps to reduce the danger of post-surgical infections because you don't have these big cuts in the body. Mm-hmm. Other sorts of less invasive kinds of manipulations could help to save many, many types of surgery. Smart cancer drugs, because cancer patients who are taking cancer chemotherapy have lower levels of white cells and are much more susceptible to infections because of that. Trying to reduce that problem is another example. And so I think there are many cases out there where the good news is that medical progress is helping to reduce the risk. We wouldn't go back to the bad old days 100%. We have learned something, and we could put – and prevention, we've also learned a lot about that.
Yeah, well, that's I think that's an important point, that what this – one of the things that it's done is that it's put more – put the focus back more on a more traditional kind of approach to infection control. Mm-hmm. And by using disinfectants and, you know, some of the things that probably we should be doing anyway, particularly in hospital settings, that's also one way to approach this that gets away from the use of antibiotics, that is trying to prevent people from getting the infection in the first place.
Well, a quick example of some progress is that in the bad old days not too long ago, the person who was responsible for infection control, if you want to call it that, was usually someone's secretary or maybe a nurse. Today, this is an infectious disease specialist, a physician who has much more clout. in a hospital setting. So we are learning slowly but surely how to handle this problem.
Yeah. Well, I will mention once again that our guest this morning, Abigail Salyers, will be talking about this very subject. This is the Center for Advanced Study 16th Annual Lecture, Revenge of the Microbes, Are Antibiotics in Danger? Tomorrow night, 7:30, in the ballroom of the Alice Campbell Alumni Center on South Lincoln Avenue in Urbana. This is a program that's open to anybody who is interested, so you certainly should feel free to stop by. She is Aaron's professor in molecular and cellular biology at the U of I, also professor of basic medical science. The book also, which we mentioned, maybe I'll mention that again, if this is something that you'd like to read up on, this is a book which he co-authored with Dixie Witt, who is also here at the U of I, Urbana-Champaign. Revenge of the Microbes, that's the title of the book, How Bacterial Resistance is Undermining the Antibiotic Miracle. And it does explain in basic sorts of ways what antibiotics are and how they work and this whole problem of disease resistance. And I think that she explained that it was her intention here to write a book that would be accessible to the general audience, to a general reader. So you don't have to have a degree in mm-hmm. biology to read this book and to understand what's right in there. And it's published by the American Society for Microbiology. Well, I thank you very much for being with us.
Okay.
We appreciate
it. Thank you.